here we are moving into springtime of the year in which we're going to choose a new president of the United States. It seems like we've already been making this choice for about a year, because U.S. elections just go on and on and on, and so much money is involved. But this one, of course, has been very, very different, because on the Democratic side, you've got Bernie Sanders giving Hillary Clinton a run for the money and drawing, well, over the weekend in the state of Washington, he drew something like 30,000 people to his rallies. And, of course, on the Republican side, you've got now Ted Cruz and John Kasich doing whatever they can to try to stop the runaway train that is Donald Trump. How does this look to the rest of the world? Well, my next guest can offer us some insight on that. Her name is Katty Kay. She is the lead anchor of BBC World News America, which airs every afternoon from Washington on BBC America at 4 p.m. Central Time here in Missouri and Illinois. She's also co-author of The Confidence Code, The Science and Art of Self-Assurance, What Women Should Know, a book she wrote with Claire Shipman. Katty, welcome to the show.
Hi, Paul.
Very nice to have you on here today. Let's just start with that very simple question. Give me an international view, if there is such a thing, of this wacky presidential election we're having.
Well, Paul, I'm actually joining you from London. I'm over here this week. And there are, you know, the two topics of conversation in Britain at the moment are the possibility of Britain pulling out of the European Union, and there's a vote on that in June, and after that, Donald Trump. And there is a level of interest in this campaign around the world, it's not just the UK, that I have rarely seen. Back in 2008, my editors were absolutely fascinated by the campaign. We had the first African-American running, the first woman running, a war hero running, and there was a lot of interest, particularly after the presidency of George Bush and the invasion of Iraq. And but this time tops even that. I mean, my editors at the BBC can't get enough of this story. They are absolutely fascinated. And that's true, you know, around the world. The Economist magazine had on its cover, I don't know if you saw it, Paul, a couple of weeks ago, a picture of Donald Trump dressed as Uncle Sam.
Yeah.
With a one-word caption, really? And that was it. And that's a reflective, I think, of what certainly the rest of Europe is thinking anyway.
So is it looking at this with a smirk? Is it looking with a shaking of the head, almost in a condescending way? Or is it looking at it with fear?
Well, that's such a great question, because I would say initially, maybe a little bit like the United States, everyone kind of thought, well, Donald Trump's not going to go anywhere. It makes the campaign lively. He's sort of funny. There was almost a joke-like quality in a way to how people saw this campaign and particularly saw Trump. Now I think we've kind of gone from thinking, you know, wow, this is funny, to, oh my God, this could be real, and there are very serious implications for other countries. And I think we're in that slightly alarmist stage with, you know, I mean, I could write you a long list of things that others have said, and they have no right really in a way, because it's not anyone else's election apart from America's election. And when foreigners try and get involved in American elections, it usually doesn't go very well. But you've had him on the front page of German magazines. You've had British magazines. You've had French magazines. You've even had J.K. Rowling weighing in on the Trump phenomenon. I think she compared him to Lord Voldemort in Harry Potter, which was maybe not very judicious, but it gives you some inclination of how people are feeling.
You mentioned people around the world have tried to influence these things if they could. And I read on your blog the other day something I did not know, that the Guardian newspaper tried to influence the Bush-Gore election back in 2000.
No, actually, it was the 2004 election.
Oh.
And it was John Kerry versus Bush, and it was Clark County, Ohio. And the Guardian newspaper, which is a left-of-center newspaper, daily newspaper here in the U.K., ran a letter-writing campaign urging their readers in the U.K. to write letters to voters in Clark County, Ohio, because they had figured out that Clark County had been a bellwether county in a bellwether state. And they were trying to tip it in favor of Kerry in the hopes that they could tip the election in favor of the Democrats. It didn't work. In the end, Clark County went for Bush, and local newspaper people and media editors said actually it was that letter-writing campaign that tipped it in favor of Bush, that quite understandably, American voters did not like the idea of being told how to vote by others.
Yeah, you know, some people are saying the same thing is happening with Trump rallies, that the more there are protests, the more people say, okay, well, I'm for Trump because of that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I've seen that too, and I've seen some of those poll numbers, particularly after Chicago, when the rally was shut down. And I think we're at a stage now, I'm sure you'd agree, Paul, in the States, where you're either for Trump or you're against him, pretty much. I don't think very many people are left to have their minds made up, and because he's so well-known and because he's had so much airtime. So if you are for Trump at this stage and Trump's rallies get shut down, I can see how that might make you more fervent in your belief that, you know, he's been saying the right things and that his rallies should go ahead.
Has there been anyone like him in the UK?
Well, this is interesting because I actually think that what is driving Donald Trump is not just an American phenomenon at the moment. You can look across Europe and see the same kinds of populism. Jeremy Corbyn is the new leader of the Labour Party. He's very far left. Yes, he's been a politician all his life, but he has that same kind of quote-unquote authenticity that voters like. He's a kind of anti-politician. Now, his politics are very different. He comes from the left, but what is driving his supporters is not dissimilar to what's driving Donald Trump supporters, a sense that people have been hard done by, that existing political figures and systems have not worked for people, that the 2008 crash caused a lot of pain amongst working middle-class people and politicians haven't been able to fix that, that globalization is causing a lot of pain for workers and that hasn't been fixed, that wages are stagnant, and immigration, of course, as well, and that there's a lot of anti-immigration sentiment here in Europe. And not just here in the UK, you can see the same sort of things with the National Front in France, with populist parties in Denmark and in Greece and in Italy. So I think that actually this is the Donald Trump phenomenon. Donald Trump is uniquely American as a figure, but the forces that are propelling him to such levels of popularity, you can find them here in Europe too.
What I find interesting about this is you mentioned Jeremy Corbyn, the new head of the Labour Party in England. He is a self-described socialist, and here we have Bernie Sanders, a self-described democratic socialist, not exactly the same thing, but that word being in there will dissuade a lot of Americans from even considering him, unfortunately. What I find amazing about the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, and I mentioned the huge crowds he's been getting, is that his message is getting airtime and mainstream exposure like no one with that voice really has in American politics for quite a long time, right?
Yeah, and I would say, you know, if you had said to me a year ago that you'd have Donald Trump on the Republican side and Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, I'd have told you to get a day job. I mean, I've said, you know, get a new job because you are no good as a political commentator. This is never going to happen. The idea that America, which is so quintessentially entrepreneurial, individualistic, could possibly fall in love to any degree with somebody who had the word socialist in their title was just anathema. It was unthinkable. Of course, Europeans are used to people describing themselves as democratic socialists, but not in the United States. I would have just thought that was impossible. And I would say that behind Bernie Sanders is some of the same things that I spoke about as being behind Donald Trump, yep. That sense of dissatisfaction and existing political norms have not helped people.
There's another part of this story that doesn't really get a lot of attention, and that is the Hillary Clinton story, again, as she did 8 years ago, trying to become our first female president, a concept in which, by the way, the United States is way behind the rest of the world. The UK had Margaret Thatcher. India had Indira Gandhi. Pakistan had Benazir Bhutto. There have been female leaders in Liberia and Lithuania and Argentina and I think probably more than a dozen others. What's taken us so long?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I would say as a British woman who lives and works in the United States that in many ways the U.S. is certainly ahead of Europe when it comes to equal opportunities for women and attitudes towards working women. But here's the difference in your political system. I think that several of the countries that you mentioned, if not all of them, are parliamentary democracies. And those women, let's take Margaret Thatcher, were elected as leader of their countries as head of their party, not as individuals running for that office. And there is a big difference. If you rise up through the British parliamentary system and you rise up through the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, you can rise up through the ranks and become the head of the party. And then that party is elected and you become leader on the back of the party. It is a slightly different system from running for president. The other thing that you mentioned at the beginning of this program was campaign finance and the amount of money it takes to run for president in the United States is eye-popping compared to the rest of the world. The last British general election cost us $75 million, and it took us 5 weeks.
Five weeks,
and that felt long enough. Not 5 years is what it sometimes feels like in the States. So I think, you know, it's perhaps not by chance that the first woman who has a real shot at becoming president also had a husband who was president and has a national profile and a national Rolodex anyway, and access to high-profile donors. It's very difficult for a woman, I think, much harder for a woman to become president in the United States running by herself as an individual than it is to become leader of a parliamentary democracy.
Yeah, although I think it's possible that as more and more women get elected to the United States Senate and to Congress, and into governorships, which has really been a great launching point for presidents in the past, that I think that will change. But still, it's rather slow.
So, I mean, yeah, and it is low. I mean, look, we've only got 20% of the Senate are women, and, you know, that's seen as a great breakthrough. 20% when women now, you know, earn more than their husbands, increasingly are better educated than men, get more degrees, more PhDs, more postgraduate degrees, spend more, control more of consumer spending, but we still only have 20% women in the Senate. It's not a huge number, right?
What do you think of this notion of a contested convention if they can somehow keep Donald Trump from getting the requisite 1,237 delegates? By the way, Kasich and Cruz don't want to use the word contested. They want to call it an open convention. But it would be contested either way.
Brokered, contested, open convention is sort of one of the white whales of American politics, something we all talk about and assume is going to happen and say that will happen and then never actually does happen. The chances, according to the bookmakers, of this happening this time around do seem to be higher. And the chances, I think, went up after Super Tuesday, too, when Donald Trump failed to win Ohio. If he'd won Ohio, I think we wouldn't even be talking about this anymore.
Yeah.
But better statisticians than I am have looked at the numbers and suggested that there is a reasonable chance that he doesn't get to 1237. Then I think we're in the stage where we're looking at shades of gray. If he gets 1230, I think it would be very hard for the Republican Party to deny him the nomination. What happens if he gets, you know, 1,150? Then what happens? So I think we'll probably see a period in which that 1,237 becomes a slightly fungible number, and then we will see what the rules actually mean in terms of whether he gets it or not.
Caddy, do you realize how British you sounded when you referred to the odds makers? Because you know in England you can bet on the presidential election.
Everything. Oh, yeah, you can book on anything, bet on anything here. And listen, they are betting on Donald Trump. I can tell you that.
I'm sure they are. And by the way, I have to mention, because you and I are both members of the media, we would like to have a contested convention because it makes a better story than, okay, we know who they're going to be, and now it's four nights of boredom.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, this campaign is a bit like crack, right, for political reporters. We can't get enough of it. And a contested convention would be incredible as a story. I actually think there is, you know, Donald Trump has said it himself, there could be riots. I'm not, you know, barring that possibility. And I have spoken to several Republicans who have said they are advising, you know, Republican consultants, they are advising clients, if you go to Cleveland and it's a contested convention, you will have to be careful. There could be violence.
I'm not sure that there will be violence, or at least large outbreaks of violence. There might be fist fights, but I don't think it's going to be anything out of control. But I think it is going to cleave the GOP in a way that they don't expect it to, because if Trump is close but not over the line, as you just mentioned, if they were to take that away from him and give it to, say, a John Kasich, I don't think they ever get those Trump supporters back into the GOP.
It's interesting, Paul, that you say you sound quite confident that there wouldn't be actual physical violence. Look, we've seen violence at Trump rallies. We saw it in Chicago to a degree that the rally had to be shut down. Now, imagine the scenario you've just outlined, where Trump supporters You know, Donald Trump gets to 1,220 votes, and the Republican Party says, no, the rules are the rules. You didn't get to 1,237. We're going to throw open this convention. People, the delegates are free to go back and vote again and nominate whoever they want. And they nominate John Kasich. I agree with you. Those Trump supporters are going to be understandably absolutely livid. And I don't rule out the possibility in a hot July, you know, after this kind of a campaign, that there could be outbreaks of violence.
But I think there will also be repercussions in November if they try to take it away from him. You know, the Republicans have a lot of down ballot issues and candidates at the state and local levels that won't have the support of those Trump GOPers who are going to stay home.
I mean, the down ballot issue is interesting because I've heard it argued, you know, convincingly either way, that Donald Trump as nominee boosts turnout and therefore helps down ballot candidates. And then I've heard down-ballot candidates who have said, listen, we will campaign and not even mention his name because we think that a Donald Trump candidacy nomination could produce an anti-Republican wave in the country, possibly even giving the Senate back to the Democrats. So it'll be, you know, we'll, I think July either way is going to be very interesting, not least because we're going, if he is the nominee, what do Republicans who have been so vehemently opposed to his candidacy do about that? How do they either kind of, you know, do a turnaround and say, okay, we're going to support him as the candidate, or stick to their guns and say, no, we're not going to vote for him? I mean, it's going to be, it puts the Republican Party in an absolutely fascinating position.
Have you had a chance to talk to any longtime GOPers? I'm not talking establishment people or Capitol Hill people, but just Americans who have been part of the Republican Party for a long time and what they have to say about what's become of their party?
So, you know, I went down to South Carolina just before the primary down there, and I wanted to do a story on exactly what you've asked, what ordinary Republicans think about Donald Trump, and particularly on the Trump ceiling. And, you know, you hear all the time how some Republicans are so dissatisfied, and people keep saying, yeah, but they're establishment types. So I spoke to a few Republicans down there, and I asked them what they thought of Donald Trump. Now, these are people who have voted. One guy had been an Air Force sergeant. He had served in Iraq and in Afghanistan. He has voted Republican his whole life. He said that if Donald Trump is the nominee, he will vote Democrat. Hmm. He will vote for Hillary Clinton. And when I asked him why, he came out with a list of reasons. Bigot, racist, misogynist, crass, rude. Those were five of the words he used to describe him. He went on much longer than I just did. And I spoke to another woman who had been a Republican her whole life. She didn't say she would vote for Hillary Clinton. She was never going to vote Democrat, but she said she would stay home.
Yeah.
And these are not exceptions.
And I think that is going to be an interesting part of the story to follow once we get into the fall, because here you have two people in Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump who both have over 50% unfavorables. But on the Republican side,
right?
On the Republican side, you've got all these people who have hated the Clintons for over 20 years and would never, ever, ever vote for Hillary Clinton. But now they're considering it. And on the other side, you've got all these people who now hate Donald Trump, who would never, ever, ever vote for him. But now, because they don't like Hillary Clinton, maybe they're considering that. My head spins.
I mean, it's quite strange in a country of 300-odd million people that both the Democrats and the Republicans seem to be choosing nominees who they dislike so much.
Before I let you go, Katie, let me get a plug in for the book that you wrote with Claire Shipman, The Confidence Code, The Science and Art of Self-Assurance, What Women Should Know. I understand it's coming out in paperback?
It's coming out in paperback in the fall, yep. We've had a great reception to the book. It's really a look at exactly what that says, where confidence comes from in our DNA, how we can build it, and why there seems to be such a big confidence gap between men and women. It's a lot of science. We interviewed tons of neuroscientists, people who are looking at confidence in things like rats. I didn't realize there were confident rats and unconfident rats, but apparently, Paul, there are.
Yep.
And really looking at this, why women are not getting to the top in the numbers they deserve and the role that confidence plays in that.
I read an excerpt in which you talk about how women just tend to be so risk-averse that it gets in their own way.
Well, so look, take this statistic, for example, that Hewlett-Packard has done work on. Men will apply for promotions when they have something like 60% of the qualifications for the job they're applying for. Women will apply for promotions when they have 100% of those qualifications. Mm. That's just one indication of how a lack of confidence, and it's not that women aren't able, we have plenty of competence, but it's an indication of how the confidence issue holds us back.
Well, I'm proud to be talking to a very confident woman in UK who is the lead anchor of the BBC World News America, which airs every afternoon at 4 on BBC America here in the Central Time Zone. She is co-author of that book, The Confidence Code, The Science and Art of Self-Assurance, What Women Should Know. She wrote that with Claire Shipman. Katty, it's really been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for your insight.
That was great fun. Thanks, Paul.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.